TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Yanis Varoufakis, The Crash of 2008 and the Pandemic of 2020. The Combination That Changed Capitalism Forever. On July 2nd, 2020, the economist and former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, gave a webinar on how the current collapse of the world economy might change capitalism forever. And it might do so by challenging the survival of private banking and the functioning of the stock exchange. Varoufakis' thesis reminded me of the headline in the September 2019 New Yorker from Bill McKibben's divestment campaign. It said, "Money is the oxygen on which the fire of global warming burns." What would it be like to abandon not just a particular investment by a bank, but the whole banking system? In this half-hour program, you will meet Rob Johnson, who moderated the talk organized by INET, the Institute for New Economic Thinking based in New York City. Rob Johnson.
Good morning, everyone, or afternoon in the case of our speaker. I'm Rob Johnson, the president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. INET's very excited and pleased to present Yanis Varoufakis on the crash of 2008, the pandemic of 2020, and the combination that changed capitalism forever. Yanis is an economist, philosopher, author, politician. He's a member of the Hellenic Parliament, Secretary General of Mayrod 25, and the co-founder of Diem 25. He was the former finance minister of Greece. Together with Bernie Sanders, he co-founded Progressive International to unite progressives around the world. He's taught economics at University of Cambridge, University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of several books, including Adults in the Room, and The Weak Suffer What They Must, and The Global Minotaur. My personal experience included a wonderful podcast with he and his wife just a few weeks ago that you can find in the Economics and Beyond series. And I will confess you can feel my heartfelt affection for this brave and imaginative man. I remember back at our Paris conference when he and Joe Stiglitz and I had a conversation, how moved I was with the courage and the illumination that he brings to bear throughout his professional and personal life. Yanis, thank you for being with us here today.
Rob, it's always a great pleasure to be with you and in proximity or through teleconferencing. Thank you so much for the introduction. And thank you for asking me to talk about something that really, touches me. Because today, there is this tendency by almost everyone, isn't there? Almost every commentator compares and contrasts the current disaster, 2020, the COVID-19-induced pause in economic activity across the world, more or less, to the crash of 2008. And the reason why I'm a bit miffed by this comparison is my conviction that it is a mistake. 2020 is not a different crisis. It's an escalation of the crisis that started in 2008. But let's begin at the beginning, as they say. In the era of global capital flows and financialization, which proceeded apace after the end of Bretton Woods, to be indulging in the standard economic analysis, looking at the American economy, the British economy, the Greek economy, the Japanese economy, all those nation-state-based analyses are bound to mislead. If we have learned anything from the last 12 years or so, maybe longer, it is that it is pointless to continue to do macroeconomic analysis the way we used to, focusing on a single country and looking at its weaknesses and strengths. The key to unlocking the mysteries around us is not anymore trade volumes or fiscal data. It is the ebb and flow of financial capital. This is why financialization has changed capitalism and the world we live in so profoundly, and why the crash of 2008, which wounded financialization very significantly, has changed the world in such a way that now a mindless piece of RNA, not even DNA, you know, COVID-19, comes along with such profound impact, because financialized capitalism was in such dire straits before COVID-19 hit us. So it is through this prism that I want us to have this conversation today of understanding 2020 as an escalation of something large that started occurring in 2008 and which never left us. The crisis I shall be proposing of financialization in 2008 never went away. Financial markets recovered, lots of money was made in them. But financialization as the linchpin of globalized capitalism has never managed to heal its wounds from 2008. In other words, if I'm correct in my hypothesis, to understand the post-COVID-19 world that we're all so keen to talk about, we cannot do that independently of understanding the post-2008 world. Now, let's take it right from the start. Once upon a time, money moved between countries, mostly to finance trade.
My apologies for interrupting this promising beginning of the story of how once upon a time money moved between countries, mostly to finance trade. I recommend you pick up Yanis Varoufakis' talk from July 2nd, 2020 on YouTube. Here now I'm moving into the question and answer section, where Varoufakis presents his most challenging ideas in practical application. Rob Johnson will be responding to Yanis Varoufakis' concluding words of his 30-minute speech.
To wind it down so that we can shift to the Q&A part that I'm very much looking forward to, my thought for the moment is that capitalism is not what it used to be. Financialization, and particularly its demise in 2008, has created new contradictions that even Karl Marx could not have imagined. At the same time, progressives are nowhere near organizing a political movement internationally in order to use state power to rejig and to plan again an economy that works for the many, not a socialism for the very, very, very few, which is what we have today. This lacuna of political organization, the lack of Franklin Roosevelt today, the lack of a political movement that can actually put the financial genie back into its bottle and rethink property rights over the new technologies that are upending capitalism anyway, separately from its crisis with financialization. This lacuna is putting us on effectively a fork in the road where we as a species must decide which way we're going to go. Are we going to move towards a dystopia in which a stagnant capitalism, 2008-2020, yields an industrial feudalism with a very few barricaded behind very tall walls and electrified fences in gated communities, and out there, you know, you have scenes like Escape from New York, if you remember the John Carpenter movie, or we're going to move into a post-capitalism that combines rationality with solidarity. Thank you.
Very, very powerful, Yanis. Very historical. What reforms do you think we have to look in the eye and demand as people to unlock the constrictions on the representation of the demos?
Ah, well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? A year ago, I would have answered in a New Dealer kind of way that what we need is to revive the important idea behind Roosevelt's New Deal of mobilizing public finance for public purpose. I still believe in that. Except that now the crisis has escalated with COVID-19 to such an extent that I think it's not enough. It's important. It's a necessary condition, but it is not a sufficient condition. Because even if we manage to do it, you know, think of Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods was a, despite its many, many, many malignancies, it was a remarkable experiment in constraining finance and shrinking inequality. Nevertheless, the system that is predicated upon capital accumulation on the basis of the separation of who works in a company and who owns the company, and the ownership of the company through the stock exchange is turbocharged through financialization. You know, even if we took Franklin Roosevelt, John Maynard Keynes, you know, Jesus Christ, the Buddha, we put them all together, and they and their angels or, you know, minions designed a global system. This process, which combines private finance and stock exchanges, will find a way of subverting it and creating another 15th of August 1971, which was the end of Bretton Woods, if you remember, when Richard Nixon was forced effectively by the system's fragmentation to end Bretton Woods. So I think that this is not just a question of mobilizing existing liquidity for good purpose. We need to do that, absolutely. It is necessary, but as I said, it's not sufficient. So what would make it sufficient? A redistribution not just of income, but of property rights. For me, the more I think about it, you know, I go back to an interesting moment in 1599, when in London, at the time when William Shakespeare was finishing off or up Hamlet, we had this remarkable decision to found the East India Company, the first joint stock corporation, with shares that were anonymous and liquid, and they could be bought and sold like pieces of silver. You know, that is a pretty remarkable thing to do, right? It's pretty remarkable thing to decide that we're going to have a huge corporation and ownership is going to be anonymous, liquid, and tradable. And independently of what this company does, who works in it, what effect it has on the world, on the environment, on the people that it exploits or it deals with. I'm increasingly drawn to the idea of shares like library cards. How about that? Does it sound very name? You go to school, you go to college, you know, you go to the New York University or Stanford or whatever, you know, your community college, and you're given a library card. It's yours. You use it. You can't sell it. You cannot even rent it or lease it to someone. It gives you access to knowledge. So how about, you know, corporations where you have one person, one vote, one share? And, you know, you accumulate capital in it on the basis of bonuses. I'm not talking about everybody receiving the same amount of money. You're going to have bonuses that are very different depending on how esteemed your contribution is amongst your colleagues. And there are voting systems that can generate that. And then when you leave, you take, you know, you trade one library card for another. You go from one college to another. You go from one company to another. That would be, of course, the end of the stock exchange. I think... And, you know, I've just finished a book about this, Rob. This is why, you know, I dare speak those words because I've put a lot of thought into it. And then my book is coming out in September. Trying to imagine post-capitalism. The more I think of it, the more I come to the conclusion that for markets to work well, we need to end capitalism. Which means what? To end private banking and end stock exchanges. So every corporation is a cooperative, one member, one share, one vote, and there's no private banking. We don't need private banking. You know, the Fed could grant every US resident a bank account. You know, what is the point of having intermediaries? You know, think about the absurdity of quantitative easing. Yeah, there is a pandemic, the economy goes down the toilet, like now, right? And what the Fed does is it lends money to Bank of America, or, you know, to Citibank, in the hope that Bank of America and Citibank is going to give it, pass it on to the people and to companies to do good things with that. Now, whenever you put a private banker between the central bank and markets out there or society, most of it disappears or ends up being misused. Because, you know, bankers have a, as you know, they have a very clear rule, never lend it to people who actually need it or who will do good things with it. Lend it to people who will speculate with it. If rational extraterrestrials were to visit planet Earth and look at stock exchanges, look at all this activity, these brilliant minds that were all day shuffling paper around, or it's not even paper anymore, it's, you know, ions in some digital space, with financial engineering and all that, creating just, you know, as Paul Volcker said, you know, when he was, remember when his comment, when he was told about all the wonderful financial engineering that was invented, he said, you know, in all my years in this business, all I have seen is new forms of debt being invented, right? So if we had, you know, imagine if each one of us had a digital account at the Fed, maybe two accounts, three accounts, savings account and a checking account, whatever. And whenever there was a crisis like now, the Fed could simply type into our accounts an additional amount of money to spend so as not to allow, you know, demand to crash, like, you know, in the middle of a pandemic now. That would work so well, and there would be no point in paying all those huge fees to bankers. And if you end the combination of private banking and share markets, then suddenly, you know, we have corporations where, you know, we make decisions democratically within them on the basis of one share, one vote. Okay? And it's remarkable how sensible people can be when given an opportunity to vote about things in their own outfits, whether it's a corporation or, you know, a town hall meeting. So how about, yeah, the idea of democratizing the economy, which means, doesn't mean the end of markets. It means the end of share markets and private banking. Therefore, I will finish off with this hypothesis of mine, because I like hearing it. I'm going to repeat it once more. The only way to have properly functioning markets is to end capitalism.
That's a beautiful paradox. One of our audience is watching from Senegal and asked the question, I can see clearly the paradoxes and their impact in the developed countries. Can you say a bit about how this plays out for the developing countries like Senegal?
Oh, thank you so much for asking this question to our friend, because it's so important. The relationship between developed economies and economies like Senegal has always been hugely important and toxic. Remember that very soon after the collapse of Bretton Woods in 1971, it was the developing countries that suffered the trials and tribulations of the first debt crisis created by the emerging financialization. Remember the structural adjustment programs of the International Monetary Fund? They started in places like Senegal, in Kenya, and so on, before, once they had honed them completely, before they brought them into the midst of Europe with the Troika programs in Greece, in Ireland, and so on and so forth. So we're all interconnected in this. The connection of the present conundrum that I described in my introduction, in my speech, if you want, with what's happening in Senegal today, I think the linchpin is the ill effects of massive minting of dollars by the Fed to keep corporates alive, because of the spillovers of this money that, you remember, immediately after 2009, 2010, there was a gash of dollars going to developing countries, seeking higher rates of return than they could find in the United States or in Europe. That created bubbles in Senegal and other countries, with the local oligarchs making ill use of this increasing debt that was coming into the country from the quantitative easing packages of the Bank of Japan, of the Bank of the Fed, of the Bank of England, and so on. that creates artificial wealth in countries like Senegal. It empowers the local oligarchs against the majority of the Senegalese. And then once panic sets in the financial markets in Wall Street, in the City of London, and so on, the money that flooded into Senegal, flood out of Senegal, the bubbles burst in Senegal, in the developing countries, and then the IMF comes in and demands the expropriation of your waterworks, your electricity grids, and the closure of your schools and your hospitals. So we're in this together. This is why I made the point that it is a gross error to imagine that we live in a world of the Americans against the Chinese, of the, you know, the Europeans against the Senegalese. No, this is a class war that is raging in every country, and the oligarchy without frontiers are very united in this. So to my friend in Senegal, your oligarchy are on very good terms with our oligarchy here in Greece, with the German oligarchy, with the American oligarchy. They have bonds of solidarity that I only wish the rest of the of humanity had.
I've got a couple of questions that feel to me like they were designed to help the president of INET with his agenda. So I'm very happy to ask. He said, could Yanis share his thoughts on the subject of economics? Are there any theories or areas in the current state that can accommodate his vision and analysis? And if not, what would be appropriate in the medium term? And then the other that comes forward is, you mentioned a lack of strong progressive political movement. Is there room for conversation on post-capitalism? And if so, what can economists and their political aides do to make it palatable to the average citizen to embrace? In other words, breaking through the ideologies that have been our false consciousness up to this time.
I'll start with the politics and then go to the economics, Rob, if I may. The answer is that, you know, this is a good moment to make inroads into the global political scene and to come up with what some of us are putting together in the form of a progressive international, a global political movement that thinks globally and acts like activists locally. I'll give you a small example, right? Remember sometime when it was in March, the story of Chris Smalls, the Amazon employee that was vilified as a result of having dared to strike or to organize a strike in New Jersey in one of the warehouses of Amazon, you know, protesting against unhygienic conditions in the warehouse. He was fired. And from what we now know, there was quite a long discussion in the board of directors of the richest corporation in the world on how to vilify him or to portray him in the media as inarticulate. Imagine if we had a global movement, let's call it the Progressive International, because some of us are creating one. We first inaugurated in November 2018 in Vermont between the Sanders Institute and our Democracy in Europe movement. In September, we are moving to Reykjavik in Iceland under the aegis of Katrin Jakobsdottir, who is the Prime Minister of Iceland, to give it another boost, to give the Progressive International another boost. So imagine if this Progressive International existed and was functioning back in March, and we could organize a worldwide strike against Amazon, consumer strike, to say, people, you know, just for one day, do not even visit their site. Just one day, it's not a big deal. It's not a great cost to people not to visit the Amazon site just for one day. But that, if it was successful at an international level, Chris Smalls would not have been fired. And we were to combine, you know, solidarity with one worker, one warehouse in New Jersey with global action. And imagine we could do this every day. One day in Nigeria, another day in India, another day in China, another day in Hong Kong, in Greece, and so on. This, to me, is what is necessary.
We're coming to the end of our time, but I want to ask you one last question, and it relates to green energy. Mm-hmm. Given this austerity prolonged recession, given the deficiency of aggregate demand, Is it possible to create what I'll call a green Keynesianism, a green fiscal policy to transform the economy and make it more resilient?
Well, we ran in the last European Parliament election under the Green New Deal. So the answer is absolutely yes. Because you see, remember, I mentioned before that since 2008, we had this disconnect, huge savings, very little investment. All we need to do, we need to take the savings and invest it. That's all we need to do, which was, of course, the original idea of FDR, Franklin Roosevelt. That was the original idea of the New Deal. You use public finance instruments in order to shift idle liquidity, idle cash, into investments. So that's what we need to do. We can do it. It's not difficult at all. Imagine a situation where, you know, in the same way that the central banks got together to save finance, imagine that we had the treasuries getting together with the World Bank to create public financial instruments, you know, green bonds that are issued collectively. Yeah? And the central banks agree to make one statement that we will buy them in the secondary markets if needs be to keep the interest rates low. Suddenly you have a huge amount of money that you can spend on green energy. So the technicalities are straightforward of how to use existing, we're not talking about creating money, we're talking about using existing money, existing savings, and putting it into good use. So yes, we can do it, but who's going to do it? You know, Roosevelt is dead. And and we didn't do very well in the European Parliament elections last year when we had this this program. One of the reasons why we didn't do well was because we did not have the money to compete with campaign financing with the juggernauts who were supported by the banking sector.
Well, Yanis, we've covered a lot of ground, a lot of, how would I say, deep and painful things to explore. Thank you for what you do for the world and to become more active and create a healthy vision for the future. And you are a contributor to that path.
Thank you so much, Rob. Thank you.
That was a goodbye between Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and Yanis Varoufakis, philosopher and teacher of economics at the University of Cambridge and the University of Austin, Texas. He's the former finance minister of Greece and now member of the Hellenic Parliament. Together with Bernie Sanders, he co-founded the Progressive International. You can find the full talk and Q&A on YouTube under the title The Crash of 2008 and the Pandemic of 2020, the combination that changed capitalism forever. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.